Okay, folks, well, I would like to do an Ask Me Anything. So I need your cooperation, though. You need to ask me anything. Okay, I have a question here from Flynn Flawn. Flynn Flawn, this is his first question. Flynn Flawn asks me about something I wrote years ago on Jan Osman. Jan Osman is a German Egyptologist, and I think one of the most interesting living writers. I hope he's still alive. I hope he's still writing. He's in his 80s now, I believe. But he wrote a book called Moses the Egyptian, which I think is an absolutely fascinating book. I wrote a review of it and then some notes on it, some subsequent sort of installations of thoughts about the book. And in one of the questions, this is way back in 2014, 2015, in one of the questions on the original publication, somebody asked me, how does Osman's vision of Akhenaten compare with what Savitri Devi has to say about Akhenaten and her various works? And I said, well, I need to think about that. And then I forgot about it, and years passed. And this donor, friend of Countercurrents, wrote in and said, I want you to answer that question, Greg. And he's been very generous. I can't say no. And I apologize to whoever I forgot to follow up with, but that was a long time ago. So let me just say a few quick things about what Osman has to say, and then I'll say a few things about Savitri. And I hope these are good thoughts. I've been thinking about this for several days now, so forgive me if I go on at great length. Osman's Moses the Egyptian basically argues that the origin of Jewish monotheism historically might have something to do with Akhenaten, the Egyptian pharaoh who became a monotheist and began to persecute the followers of the other gods of Egypt. He ruled for about 12 years. And when he died, his heresy continued for a few years. And then there was a restoration of orthodoxy, and his name was basically erased from Egyptian history. And he was forgotten about until really the late 19th century when he was rediscovered. And the essential thing about him that's interesting is that he's treated as the founder of religious intolerance, if you will. And in Moses the Egyptian, Osman coins a term, the Mosaic distinction. And the Mosaic distinction is basically this idea that you get in the Bible that if the God of Israel is the one true God, then all the other gods are false. If the God of Israel is good, all the other gods are evil, and therefore they must all be destroyed. Now, the peoples of the ancient world up to that time never had this attitude that if their gods were true, that meant that the other gods worshipped by their neighbors were false. Instead, what they would do is try and establish some kind of correspondences, analogies between their pantheons and the pantheons of neighboring peoples. And it's analogous to how peoples who spoke different languages would try and come up with translations, right? They would try and understand what the Akkadian word for the sun is. The Egyptians would try and understand that, and vice versa. And in the same way, the Egyptians would try and understand what the Akkadian sun god was and its equivalent to their gods. And so they would try and establish translations, basically, between their gods and other deities. And this was basically a way of achieving mutual understanding. There was no sense that, there was no presumption that their pantheon was true and all the others were false. That was something that came into history with the Jews. However, it first appeared with Akhenaten. Akhenaten upheld the sun, he called it the Aten, as the only god. And at first, he tried to uphold this alongside the other gods in Egyptian polytheism. But then at a certain point, he closed all the other temples and he banned the worship of the other gods of Egypt. And so he seems to be the originator of the Mosaic distinction, and therefore the person who bequeathed us the tradition of biblical religion, one of the essential ideas of biblical religion, which has given rise to a huge amount of religious warfare and intolerance. The one reason why the peoples of the ancient world found the Jews so appalling, and then later Christians so appalling and dangerous, politically dangerous, is because they taught that the gods of other peoples were false, and that they were idolaters, and their religions had to be destroyed, which of course was a warrant for genocide, a warrant for constant war. And therefore, to maintain peace, they believed that these peoples had to be oppressed. They had to be persecuted. And this is why the Romans, for instance, persecuted Christians. They persecuted them not because they were religiously intolerant, but because they believed that Christians were the people who created religious intolerance. The Jews were religiously intolerant, but they sort of kept to themselves, whereas Christianity maintained the intolerance of the Jews, but then wedded it to a universalistic, crusading, proselytizing faith. That made it far more potentially destructive. And of course, Islam was basically cut from the same cloth, and another crusading, universalistic, and intolerant faith. Great mischief got into the world with the Mosaic distinction, in other words. And Osman regrets it. He talks about how with Judaism came religious violence, religious fanaticism, and religious persecution, and that it spawned a tradition of this through Christianity and Islam as well. It's a powerful argument, and it coincides with the critiques in antiquity of Judaism, Christianity, and later. And of course, by the time Islam came about in the West, paganism was gone, but in the East, there was still paganism, right? The Hindus were pagans. And the critique of Islam that you got from Hindus was very much like the critique you had in the ancient European pagan world of Christianity and Judaism. It doesn't understand religion. It takes one particular religious faith as the truth and confers, therefore, that others are false, they're lies, they're pernicious, and they have to be destroyed along with their adherents. So anyway, that's basically the Osman teaching. Now, it's very interesting. Savitri Devi admired Akhenaten, but Savitri Devi didn't admire Jews. And Savitri Devi overlooked the crusading intolerance of Akhenaten's monotheism. She would have criticized Judaism and Christianity and Islam for that kind of monotheistic intolerance, but she doesn't really criticize it in Akhenaten. And in fact, she seems to want to sort of write that out of Akhenaten and treat his attack on Egyptian polytheism as a political thing. There was a certain point at which Akhenaten closed the temples and arrested the priests and tried to suppress Egyptian polytheism. She interprets that as a reaction to some sort of attack on the pharaoh by the priesthood. And so it's a political thing. It's not an ideological thing. It's not something that's of the essence of his particular form of monotheism, which she wants to interpret as something that's consistent with sort of a broad mystical pantheism. And she therefore would be very close to what Osman talks about as cosmotheism. And cosmotheism is this idea that basically the divine has many masks. There's a sort of unified divine principle in the world, but it takes on many masks and many mythologies, as many mythologies as there are peoples. But since there's an underlying reality that all of these mythologies refer to, it's possible to establish, if you will, tables of correspondences, translations between these mythologies, which is what ancient peoples tried to do. In the same way that we can talk about the sun in Akkadian and the sun in Egyptian, because they both point to the same objective reality, namely the sun. So that's basically my take on this. And I appreciate the question. I think it's a good question. And I apologize to the original questioner that I put off so very long ago. ABC writes in with two questions. I very much appreciate that. He gives $5. What are your thoughts about the Pentagon hearings on UFOs? If far advanced aliens do exist, do we want them to be soft, progressive liberals, or race, species aware, tough Darwinists? That's a really interesting question. I haven't been following this. Honestly, I don't want there to be aliens, really. I would rather be alone in the universe. Why? Well, because I know the history of life on Earth, and I know the history of what happens when relatively primitive peoples get visited by more advanced peoples. And it's usually not pretty. I don't want to have to trust in the benevolence of silicon-based life forms. I think that if we are sharing the universe with other creatures, that's a very, very dangerous thing. Do we want them to be soft, progressive liberals, or race, species aware, tough Darwinists? Obviously, I want them to be soft, progressive liberals. Or if not soft, progressive liberals, at least have a live and let live attitude. Let's put it that way. It's a big gamble, though. ABC also writes in with $5. Could some accelerationists be a product of methods, as in the Manchurian Candidate or the Truman Show, in order to exploit them politically, like passing an unconstitutional domestic terrorism bill right after Buffalo? I think it's conceivable. I don't know if it's true, right? And we have to have evidence that it is true. And the trouble is that there really are people like Peyton Gendron who really are genuine white nationalists. You know, they're concerned with the things that we're concerned with. And they just make a very dumb mistake and do the shooting thing. Now, some people have suggested that maybe what we have here is a case of people who are profoundly disturbed, ticking time bombs first, and then they latch on to our movement as a sort of after the fact rationalization for doing that kind of stuff. That's possible too. I would need to see evidence of that. The truth is, though, that there are genuine people who do this kind of stuff. And therefore, if there are genuine people who do this kind of stuff, the government doesn't need to manufacture them. However, if these people didn't exist, yes, they probably would manufacture them. I just don't see that we get anything politically by speculating about this in the absence of fact. I do not think that we gain anything by being people who immediately start saying it's a false flag. It's like, it's fake. It's fake. Why is it helpful to just deny the reality of certain things up front? I just don't get it. It's an expression of the fact you don't trust the establishment. Yeah, fine. I don't trust the establishment either, but I don't accuse them of lying and hoaxing without actual evidence of that. Just because these people are capable of anything doesn't mean that you have evidence of them doing this particular thing, right? So I just think we need to wait and see about this. There will be a trial, almost certainly. More stuff will come out about Peyton Gendron. But until then, I just think we could take him at face value, because I don't find it impossible that people who believe the kinds of stuff that I believe about the Great Replacement could go off and do dumb stuff like this. I do think that what he did is dumb. He actually embraced the strategy of the Christchurch shooter, Tarrant. Tarrant's idea was to provoke the establishment and give the establishment a pretext for tearing up our First and Second Amendment rights. And he thinks that once we don't have a First and Second Amendment, we'll be so outraged that somehow, in the absence of free speech and in the absence of guns, we'll finally get together and do something about these people. I just think that's a dumb strategy, and it's a risky strategy. The other thing that these people all assume is something that I want to call the mimetic fallacy. They think that, yeah, what they're doing may be a crazy one man with a gun type of thing, but if a million men imitate them, then it becomes something. Well, a million men won't imitate them. One or two will. Peyton Gendron is an example. But a million men aren't going to imitate them. Not enough people are going to imitate them, and it's not going to amount to anything. Moreover, the chances of people actually imitating them depend upon, well, it depends upon what kind of image is fashioned of them. And we have very little power to fashion the images that are created of what we do. And because we don't have that power, it's far more likely that the people who do enjoy this power are going to be able to fashion Peyton Gendron or Brenton Tarrant into images of things that support their agendas, not ours. And beyond that, I'm going to say that I'm going to veto their dream to the extent that I have any power at all in our field by mocking these people and criticizing these people, condemning these people, and trying to make anybody who thinks about this for even a minute just cringe in embarrassment at the thought of imitating these people. So I think those are reasons to reject this sort of mimetic idea that, yeah, it might be crazy for one guy to do it, but millions may imitate him. No, I don't think that's likely at all. I think that's very, very silly. So the whole thing is based on completely goofy calculations. It's true that there is a great replacement. There's no question about that. But the idea that we can stop it by shooting up old black women while they're shopping is nuts. It's just completely nuts. It doesn't help. It helps the establishment. We do know that the security state feeds on terrorism. Nietzsche said this in the 19th century. He said, "Kings have never sat more securely on their thrones since anarchists started shooting at them." Why is that? Because it gave the kings pretexts for cracking down on people. And believe me, there's been a lot more cracking down. A lot more cracking down is possible in the early 21st century than was possible in the late 19th century. These people feed on violence. Their power feeds on violence. That gives them the pretext to crack down even more, and we shouldn't give them the pretext to do that. Okay, so that's my basic thought about that. So those are both good questions, and I very much appreciate your generosity. So thank you. So Dino writes in, "Judaism and Islam worship the lunar calendar because they travel at night in the desert. The sun was in their eyes an oppressive god." This is true. And honestly, Egypt is a very sunny country, and it's oppressively sunny. And making the sun the one god and worshiping the one god in the open air was sort of a weird, oppressive thing. There were these ambassadors from somewhere, Mesopotamia, which was certainly oppressively sunny, who criticized Akhenaten and complained that he kept them waiting for hours in the sun. You don't worship the sun in an oppressively sunny society. Yeah, you're more likely to have lunar gods than solar gods in sunny countries. One of the speculations that Savitri Devi has is that Akhenaten's solar religion might have been influenced by the Mitannians, because Mitannians were an Indo-European speaking people in upper Mesopotamia. And the Indo-Europeans and their pantheons are more solar-centric because they came from the north. And so because Akhenaten had Mitannian ancestry in his family, and there were Mitannian princesses who had been married into the Egyptian royal family, he might have been exposed to certain Aryan, Indo-Aryan solar ideas. But of course, he didn't have to go too far back in Egyptian history to find solar cults, but they weren't as central as they were in his time. Obviously, he made it the religion. The sun, you can't not worship the sun. It's a great power, but it was quite an extraordinary thing to make it the one god. That's an interesting point. Thank you. Okay, so I have another question here. This comes from the other Greg. The other Greg wants me to comment on how valuable is the U.S. Constitution, because the other Greg has been going back and forth with people on DLive who are poo-pooing the U.S. Constitution. And the general response is, bah, the Constitution is just a scrap of paper. Why treat the U.S. Constitution seriously? It didn't work very well when we sent it to Liberia, hardy har har. Well, you know, there's some points there, definitely. Obviously, there's something more to the U.S. system of government than just the scrap of paper, the Constitution. There was a people in North America before there was any United States, before there was a Constitution. The Constitution didn't create the people. The people created the Constitution. Who were these people? They were largely people descended from the British Isles. They were overwhelmingly Protestant. They were WASPs. They were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, basically, who on the North American continent had created a new form of British society, and they wanted to get rid of the king. They wanted to have a republic. And they created a constitution, and they set in paper certain things that were part of the British tradition. They wanted these things to be put down explicitly on paper so that people wouldn't forget them. Things like freedom of speech, non-establishment of religion, privacy rights, and so forth, the right to bear arms, etc. These things were set down because they were important to the British derived peoples who created the Constitution in America. Now, if you don't have that kind of people and its traditions, Xeroxing the U.S. Constitution and sending it to Africa is not going to produce the same effects, because obviously you need more than the Constitution. You need the people and their traditions. That's an important point. However, we are besieged people in America. We have enemies in America who are extremely powerful, who would like to shut it all down, who would like to take our guns away, who would like to censor us and imprison us for thought crimes. And whatever reverence that people have for the Constitution as a document and for the founders as wise men, that stands in their way is not something to be poo-pooed and dismissed. The United States has the First and Second Amendment. We'd be far worse off without them. And people who want to sneer at that are just, I don't know what they're smoking, but they're out of touch with reality. So there's some very good things about the United States that we do enjoy. They're largely connected with the Constitution. However, sadly, the people that created the Constitution and to whom it makes sense are being replaced. And eventually it's going to be a dead letter, because there won't be any Anglo-Saxons around, or Europeans more broadly around, who appreciate these institutions and practices like freedom of speech. That's why the Great Replacement is happening, and that's why it has to be stopped. There's a written constitution, and that's important, but the unwritten constitution, namely the people and their traditions, has to be preserved as well. You can't keep the Constitution and switch out the people and say that you're somehow a conservative, which is what the fake National Review type conservatives say. We can still have America even if everybody's brown. That's not true. It won't work. It won't happen. Okay, so thank you. Thank you for that, the other Greg. I appreciate that. It's a good question. I have a question here that is related to both Flynn Flon's question and the other Greg's question, and it comes from everybody's favorite cat, Lovecraft's cat. And Lovecraft's cat just writes in with the question, what's the matter with liberalism? Okay, so that's a good question, and I'm going to give a great big answer to it. And I've been thinking about this a lot. So what's the matter with liberalism? Well, first of all, we need to establish some context here. People valued liberty, and people valued liberty long before there was something called liberalism. People valued private life long before there was something called liberalism. People valued freedom of speech, freedom to participate in the government of their own societies, etc., long before there was something called liberalism. If you know anything about the history of the West, if you know anything about the history of the Greek city-states, if you know anything about the history of Rome, about the medieval Western civilization, the various city-states in Italy and places like that during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, people appreciated liberty, private life, the ability to participate in politics, the ability to engage in self-government long before there was a theory called liberalism. So you cannot allow people to say, you criticize liberalism? That means you must love tyranny. No. Liberalism is just one theory, one particular political ideology that puts itself forward as a champion of freedom, a champion of equality, etc. It isn't freedom. It's a theory of freedom. And I think it's a very flawed theory of freedom. So I want to talk about the four stages of liberalism, analogous to the four stages of cancer. There is no fifth stage of cancer, and there is no fifth stage of liberalism. So what is stage one liberalism? Stage one liberalism is liberalism as an idea, liberalism as a set of promises. Liberalism comes about in early modernity largely as a response to the religious wars that came about because of the Reformation, which brings us to the Osman issue, right? Osman talks about how Judaism created religious intolerance, and Christianity accepted this essential Jewish idea that there's only one truth, and if you stray from it, that makes you a bad person who deserves to suffer all kinds of suffering in this life and the next, right? And therefore, when the monopoly of the Catholic Church broke down, you had different Christian sects that were looking upon one another as infidels and were willing to persecute one another with absolute insane ferocity. And this went on for more than 100 years. From 1517 to practically the end of the next century, Europe was having religious wars between Catholics and Protestants. It was a tremendously destructive period of time. So people said, well, let's come up with an alternative view of politics that tries to take quarrels about religion out of the equation. And one of the ways that they tried to do this was at the end of the 30 Years' War with the Peace of Westphalia, they created this idea of the sovereign state. The sovereign state that doesn't answer to any external power, like the Pope, for instance. And the Westphalian settlement was basically that at the end of the war, the religion of the prince in a particular principality would be the religion of the people, and that would be the end of the struggle. And, you know, there would be Catholic states and Protestant states, and they would be sovereign, and they wouldn't have to answer to foreign powers. It was an attempt to basically take Christianity out of politics so that they could bring an end to the wars. Now, they went a lot further with liberalism as an ideology. Liberalism as an ideology basically says, look, we will give you peace if you stop talking about the common good of society, the objective moral truth for mankind, the proper ends of human life, etc. Because if we talk about these things, we are doomed to civil war and bloodshed like we just had with the post-Reformation struggles. It's not true. It's a very bad argument. The reason why there was so much war and bloodshed was not that people were arguing about the proper ends of life, the virtues. It was because they were arguing about things like transubstantiation and the papacy, right? It would have been completely possible to have classical virtue ethics and to say that the purpose of the state is to make people more virtuous, make people more courageous and self-controlled and honorable, things like that. There was very little disagreement on these sorts of ends, proper ends, moral principles, virtues, whatever you want to call them. But we were told that it was just too dangerous to talk about virtue anymore. And therefore, instead of having a society that was based on the idea of common virtues and a common way of life, and a state that took responsibility for cultivating the character of the citizens, all these things would have to be privatized. We would have to get this out of politics, get religion out of politics, get virtue out of politics, and that people would simply follow their own private interests, right? There would be no common good. There would just be private interests. They promised us peace for that. And they also said, this is a great form of freedom. It's freedom to define yourself, freedom to become yourself. And beyond that, they said, if we could do this, we will enjoy peace and prosperity. Because even though they said, let's get rid of talk of any common good of society that society has to aim at, they suddenly produced their own image of the future. It was an image of a future where people enjoyed greater peace and prosperity, because once you had pacified humanity and gotten religion quieted down, science and technology would be able to conquer nature and deliver peace, not just peace, but prosperity, longevity, things like that. So that's what liberalism, the idea, promised. Okay, so that's phase one, stage one of liberalism. Then there's stage two liberalism. Stage two liberalism is liberalism in practice. Okay, liberalism in practice has problems. Okay, and what are the problems? Well, basically the problem with liberalism in practice is this. Society depends upon common traditions, common meanings, and yet these things are not to be cultivated by the state. They're not to be pursued by the state anymore. And so what they are is they just sort of remain there in the background as a kind of capital that we inherit from the past. But the state, the educational system, they don't seek to increase that capital. They seek to let us all draw down that capital. They say, okay, we all have a common language and common traditions and common sociability that makes society possible. We can enjoy this, but now our task is to define our own aims, define our own identities, define our own meanings, and so forth. Well, if you believe that, then this heritage that makes society possible, this cement that makes society possible, is seen suddenly as an impediment to individual self-definition. So individuals start looking upon the tradition of sociality that makes life possible, common ways of life as an impediment. And so they start undermining them. They start dismantling them because that produces more and more freedom. Well, the trouble with that is that it not only produces more freedom, it also unleashes bad behavior, right? So let's just talk about the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution promised us all more sexual pleasure. And all we had to do was get rid of certain rules that were sort of traditions about sex that were getting in the way of sexual pleasure. Well, the sexual revolution has failed about as badly as the Bolshevik revolution at this point. Because instead of giving us a world where more people have more sexual pleasure, we now have a world where we have more lonely people who don't have stable relationships, who don't have sex, who don't have families and don't have children. It's failed, right? And it's failed because there was something about those traditions that was helpful. For instance, if you had defined sex roles, it was pretty easy for you to know what you're going to get, right? When you would engage in a conversation with a member of the opposite sex. Once those were dismantled, it becomes very, very difficult to have those conversations. You don't have any rules. You don't have any guidelines. And so it just becomes fraught with difficulties and uncertainties that didn't exist before when everybody just sort of followed the prescribed roles. So liberalism in practice leads to the breakdown of social traditions that make civilized life possible and leads to an increase in friction and conflict in society. And so in order to deal with these problems, like say date rape and stuff like that, it's real, right? There's certainly more of it now than there was when dating consisted of meeting on the front porch with members of your family, your parents present, things like that, right? When dating moved from the front porch to the back seat of the car, there was a lot more date rape happening. Well, how to undo that? Do we go back to the front porch thing? Do we go back to being more decorous and having parents around, chaperones around? Hell no. That would be winding the clock back, and we are told we can't do that. What we need is we need the nanny state. We need various programs. We need DEM programs, right, to correct the problems caused by liberation from society's norms, traditions that we're starting to miss because suddenly there's more bad behavior and people just don't know how to act. They don't know how to get along. They don't know how to be happy. And so we have unhappy people who are demanding the state make them happy. This is liberalism in practice. Okay, when liberalism in practice grinds on long enough and enough people are made unhappy, people like me start talking about maybe changing things. How about we examine liberalism's idea of freedom? Maybe it's the wrong idea of freedom. You know, the ancients talked about freedom, but when they talked about freedom, they talked about, say, the freedom of a city, which meant its sovereignty. They meant the freedom of people to engage in self-government, to participate in government, and they meant the freedom of the individual to govern his own passions. Freedom was defined in contradistinction to your desires. It was a form of ruling over your desires. Freedom and law, freedom and morality were considered one and the same thing because law and morality both quell forces of chaos and disorder. And when you start defining freedom as the freedom of these forces that were quelled by classical and medieval political thought and moral philosophy, well, then you're going to get a lot more disorder and chaos in society, and you're going to have a lot of cries for order. And it's not going to be the order of traditions. It's going to be the order of the state. It's going to be mechanical order imposed by above. It's going to be order imposed by the police and by bureaucrats and by scolds in the media, right? By propaganda. That's the new kind of order. And if you start questioning that, at a certain point, liberals discover, wait a second here, we can't just allow people to say and believe anything. Liberalism isn't a suicide pact, after all. We can't be so foolish and so liberal as to allow people to criticize liberalism. And so we get to stage three of liberalism, which is liberalism as a farce. Liberalism as a farce is what we have today, where we have the greatest crusading advocates of censorship are the people who call themselves liberals. Why are they doing this? Because liberalism has proved so problematic that people are criticizing it. And instead of listening to the critics and trying to fix the problems, they just want to shut the critics down and maintain liberalism. So liberalism becomes tyrannical. Liberalism becomes illiberal. Liberalism is a farce. That's stage three of liberalism. Well, once liberalism is a farce, stage four of liberalism, you can just describe as liberalism as racket, right? Liberalism as a farce gets going because these people believe that, you know, liberalism is a very, very important thing and it has to be protected against illiberal critics, right? You have to censor people who are intolerant. You can't tolerate the intolerant, right? That kind of stuff. You can't allow people to think illiberal thoughts and express illiberal ideas, or we could have bloodshed and chaos. We'll have tyranny, right? So underlying that is belief. But at a certain point, all belief just goes out the window because it becomes such a long-term farce. And then the only thing that is maintaining it is just the racket. And what's liberalism as a racket? Well, it's just the bureaucracy, the legacy media, big business, the establishment that identifies itself with liberalism, wants to hold on to its power and repel all comers. At a certain point, the mask becomes less and less important. It's just a sheer power play. They're not even concerned about being consistent with ideological matters. It's just all a matter of who whom. You know, and this is what we're seeing now. We're entering the phase where it's openly just a racket. I love how the mask falls off. For instance, Gretchen Whitmer, once Roe v. Wade was threatened, Gretchen Whitmer says, "I'm going to stand up for absolute bodily autonomy." This was one of the worst governors for crackdowns and lockdowns and mask mandates and stuff like that. Absolute bodily autonomy meant nothing when liberals were on their COVID crusade. But now that Roe v. Wade is threatened, now that the ability to basically abort your children at will is threatened, suddenly they're for absolute bodily autonomy. It's so obvious at this point to most people. And they're not even trying to hide the fact that they're just in it to maintain their power as a class, right? They're still going through the motions of giving justifications. But if you look at the justifications, they're so self-contradictory that at a certain point, they're just going to stop justifying it all. And it's just going to be the sheer rule of this minority, this tiny minority of people who have socially liberal attitudes and are usually extremely rich. It's going to be the open rule of the left-wing oligarchy that's in place without any ideological pretenses whatsoever. That is the fourth stage of liberalism. It's just liberalism as racket. And at a certain point, you can't even call it liberal anymore because they're not going to be even using the phrase liberalism. And like cancer, there is no fifth stage. There's nothing further that can happen that could be called liberal at that point. What'll happen is it either morphs into just open totalitarian oligarchy, or it falls apart and something new is put in place. So what's the matter with liberalism? Well, it's an inadequate theory of liberty. It's an inadequate theory of private life. It basically doesn't understand what makes societies work. What makes societies work are certain practices that people have, certain traditions that allow people to understand one another and live together. And when you define liberty as loosening the bounds of tradition and being able to basically define who you are and what's good and bad for yourself, you're going to find that that creates social chaos and a lot of hurt feelings. And rather than rejecting the underlying expressive individualism of liberalism, liberal ideology, they simply want the state to come in and make their hurt feelings feel better. And so it starts morphing into the totalitarian racket, the totalitarian farce, and then ultimately just the racket of the open totalitarian rule of the professional managerial class and the obscenely rich oligarchy that they serve. So that's what's wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with liberty. And I would even say that there's nothing wrong with equality as political ideals. It's just that there are other values that are often more important than them. And even liberals will admit that there are certain things that are more important than these things once their power is threatened, right? And then they start saying, well, we need emergency measures to take away freedom of speech in the name of preserving liberalism, right? Oh, well, if they're willing to entertain that when they're criticized, why won't they just entertain the possibility that there are values higher than liberty? And that those values have to be something more than just their hold on power, right? The naked power lust of the current establishment. Maybe there are things like, I don't know, civilization, virtue, traditions, things like that, that are more valuable than liberty, especially liberty defined as individual self-expression, self-definition. So that's a very long answer. I appreciate the question. Gaelic Nord writes, it's a worldview that promises freedom, but funny enough, all it has created is more prisons in the mentality of those who believe in it. Yeah, that's a lot of truth. Liberalism went from wanting to liberate oneself from Christian dogma to now wanting to liberate oneself from biology itself. Yeah, exactly. And I don't mind liberating society from Christian dogma. That's something that was absolutely necessary. But liberation from nature? No, that's craziness. And it can't be done. Frankly, it can't be done. Orpheus Victorious, they substitute the state for husband and substitute cats for children. There's a lot of truth for that. Reed Johnson writes, under liberalism, women don't marry men, they marry the state. Dating used to lead to marriages and children. Now everyone just argues about who pays for what. Exactly. These are all very good points. I really appreciate all of this. Monotheism is okay until you impose it on others. My God is better than. Yeah, there was a kind of mystical monotheism in pagan antiquity. This is what Osman talks about under the moniker cosmotheism, which is a term used by William Pierce in a different way, right? But cosmotheism for him is this idea that there's an underlying divine reality that has many masks and many manifestations, including the different pantheons of particular historical peoples. Okay, that kind of monotheism is consistent with polytheism, right? Because the one divine reality is manifested in different polytheistic pantheons by different peoples. It's also consistent with the diversity of cultures and so forth. It's not a driving force, an engine of cultural assimilation, of intolerance, etc. That really comes in with the Mosaic distinction, with the Jewish idea of the one God, and which means that all the other gods are untrue. Okay, so good point. Orpheus Victorious writes in with $5. This is very kind of you. Any thoughts on the upcoming monkeypox pandemic? Well, let's hope that there isn't a monkeypox pandemic. I'm sure there's some people who would love to have another pandemic. the sort of pandemic drama queens would like that. I think that there'd be blood in the streets if people started talking about lockdowns for monkeypox, though. Let's hope that people have had enough. It's something to worry about, definitely. Has anybody ever died of monkeypox, though? I don't know. It's a good question. Eric writes in, and he has several quick questions. So let me just answer these quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Okay. He wants me to name... he wants my thoughts on prostitution. Okay, I can't give a short answer to that. I really don't like the idea of prostitution, I guess. But I would have to think about that. Have to be thoughtful about that. That's a long answer thing, not a short answer. And we're running out of time, folks. He also asks, have you met anybody in your life you would describe as an asshole? Yes, many, many people. Can you name names? Well, I don't want to. But yeah, there are many assholes that I've met in my life, most of them in connection with this movement, but we cannot lose track of the fact that the best people I've met, the people that I admire the most in my life, are also people I've met in connection with this movement. So, and they far outweigh the assholes. They really do. So don't let the assholes scare you off from getting involved in white identity politics, because you'll meet some of the best people you ever meet in this. Some of the people who are the bravest, some of the people who are the smartest, and some of the people who combine intelligence and bravery together the best. So, and he also says, H.G. Wells, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, and Robert Heinlein are highly regarded for writing science-based speculative fiction. What writers working now are regarded as their equivalent? Well, I guess I would put it, what writers do I regard as their equivalent? I can't think of anybody I regard as their equivalent. Although I do have to admit that if you take away the offensively multiracial casting and associated propaganda elements of The Expanse, which I haven't read as books, but I have watched as series, I think that is pretty darn good speculative fiction. I like that a lot. I also really liked, and in a way, the best of this work is in movies, not in books. Certainly what I'm aware of is in the form of movies, not books. But I honestly think that the creators of Firefly, Joss Whedon and the other writers of Firefly, did absolutely amazing science fiction. You know, it's sort of a space Western, right? But it is fantastic. I don't know if you call that science-based. There's sci-fi elements to it. I don't care for the hard science stuff. And I find it really, really nerdy when people criticize sci-fi for not being scientific in their eyes. So there's some good work out there. I just don't read a lot of popular sci-fi or any popular fiction for that matter. But I do watch certain things. And I did think The Expanse was a very, very imaginative series. I did think the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, for that matter, was an extremely imaginative sci-fi story. And I very much liked Whedon's Dollhouse, too. Not just Firefly, but also Dollhouse was extremely imaginative science fiction. So a lot of it is done for TV and movies. And it's definitely worth taking a look at. So, folks, that does it for today. Tomorrow on the Writer's Block, we will have Nick Gilvey welcoming Carl Thorburn, our own Carl Thorburn, to talk about mutual assured destruction, the idea of basically maintaining peace through the balance of terror, the central Cold War deterrence doctrine. We're going to talk about that. And I am sure you're going to have tons of questions about that topic as well as current events that they will also answer as well. The Writer's Block starts at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and 10 p.m. Central European time. So please tune in tomorrow for the Writer's Block. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. I want to thank all of you listeners out there. I want to thank the donors. I want to thank the moderators, and I will let you know who the next guest is sometime in the coming week, and we will be back for another episode. Thank you.